Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. It's November 13th, 2019. I am Fran Storchendi, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can call us at 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. So we've got more highlights from the 2019 New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors Conference because it was such a rich conference. It was full of so much incredible information. But before I go there, I have a bit of a, as you call it, a frant.
Yeah,
a friend.
It's a Fran rant.
Yeah, I know.
Cool.
So just a little bit. So one of the things that I'm hearing is that people are becoming vegetarians in order to increase their health. And while I like the idea of being a vegetarian, if it gets you to eat more vegetables, I think that's fine. But what I'm hearing people say, what you need to really do is cut back on your meat consumption and think of meat as more of a condiment and not the main, not your main course, and that you want to eat a lot more vegetables and just think of the meat as a condiment. I have to tell you, what I see in my practice, I don't see that people eat too much meat. That's not what they do. They do not eat enough vegetables. That's definitely true. But what I see is, you know, when you're talking to people about eating meat as a condiment, what I'd really like to hear them talk about is eat grains as a condiment, eat starch and sugar as a condiment. That is what I see. I don't see people coming in and having huge omelets with bacon and sausage for breakfast, except for maybe on the weekends. And then, you know, huge steaks for lunch and, you know, with homeopathic vegetables and, you know, big slabs of chicken breast for dinner. That is not what I'm seeing, unless they're keto carnivores, in which case they do. And they're very rare. And if you're doing keto carnivore right and you need to do it for your health, that's one thing, to wit my dear friend Carl Goldkamp, who healed himself being keto carnivore. But that is not what I see. I don't see people eating too much meat and therefore they need to be told to eat more vegetables and have meat as a condiment. What they need to be told is to eat starchy foods as a condiment and have sugar maybe a couple times a week or have a very tiny amount of sugar during your day. People, what I do see is people having lots of starchy food all throughout the day. And that is the thing that they eat the most of. And if that's you, this is something you really want to think about, because starchy food is going to raise your blood sugar. It's going to increase your insulin. It's going to, it's going to increase inflammation, and it's going to make you gain weight. If most of what you're eating is starchy food, if you're not happy with your energy or your weight, or you have digestive problems and you're eating, you know, a big bowl of oatmeal or a muffin for breakfast with a big coffee with lots of sugar and cream in it and that's your breakfast. And then you're having a sandwich for lunch that's mostly bread. And then you're having pasta for dinner and there's not much vegetables in it. That needs to be changed. That's not going to keep you healthy. And I'm not sure why. I mean, what I heard today, I heard a public service announcement where the public service person was suggesting that people eat meat as a condiment, which is fine. I mean, you know, adjusting your protein consumption is perfectly fine. And my belief about protein consumption is that you need to adjust your protein to your needs. And there may be some people who are eating more meat than they need to eat, but that is not generally what I see. People don't spend as much money on meat. Meat, you know, animal protein is expensive, and people tend to fill up on carbs. That's what they tend to fill up on. Why don't you hear eat starchy foods as a condiment? What's up with that? Is that because it's subsidized and it's easy for people to get to? And I mean, because that's really what's making people sick, that they're overstarching and oversugaring.
It's cheap is what it is. It's less expensive to eat that way.
Yes, it is.
And I think that's what people do, is they spend their money in strange places. And rather than spend their money on really eating good food, they spend their money on healthcare. And their healthcare is pharmaceutical based, and it's really expensive, and you're not saving money by not eating well.
No, ultimately, well,
you're actually losing.
There's also, you know, there's the cost of your health. I mean, that has an unspeakable value. I mean, if you're not healthy, what good is it? If you're
right.
sick all the time, if you're in pain, if you're overweight, if you're diabetic, and your health is at stake, I mean, that's worth any price. I understand if people don't have enough money, but there can be solutions to that. I mean, there are food pantries, there are SNAP benefits that you can use at farmers markets and at food co-ops. You don't have to be stuck with a completely starchy diet. And, you know, with those public service announcements aren't just for people who don't have a lot of money. They're for anybody. And, you know, they're aimed at people of all socioeconomic levels. So if you have money and you're eating a very starchy diet, you may want to rethink that. And eating meat as a condiment is a good idea if you're eating a large selection of produce, and produce is mostly what you're eating, and that works for you. And of course, meat as a condiment might not be the best idea if you're an athlete, if you're working out very hard. On days that you have a really heavy workout to the point where you're actually sore from your workout, you could probably eat meat as more than a condiment. But, you know, watch the starch. Starchy foods, if you eat starchy foods, if you're someone who can have some level of starchy foods, everybody's different. The diet that works for you is going to be whatever one works for you. There are some guidelines that you can give, but really with diets, you have to be a detective and not a dieter, and you have to figure out what works for you, what level of carbs you can eat, if any, what level of produce you can eat, whether you need to eat meat as a condiment or you need to have more animal protein, or you want to try having no animal protein at all. I hear a lot of people say, I'm going to get really healthy, I'm going to become a vegetarian. And when I look at what they're eating, their problem is not that they're overeating meat. Their problem is that they're overeating starch. Now, if you become a vegetarian means to you that you're going to eat a lot more vegetables, then that's great. And if you look at, you know, with the combination of Dr. Oz and Mark Hyman's idea of the PGAN diet, where you're basically eating like a vegan and you're eating a lot of produce, and, you know, Mark Hyman does have that idea of condom meat, eating meat as a condiment, and you want to do that, that's great. But people's protein needs are going to vary from person to person. And as you get older, you also need to eat more protein because your ability to absorb it decreases. So you need to eat more to head that off. Also, if you work out hard enough that you get sore the next day, you can take amino acids. You can just have protein within a half an hour of your workout, and your body is very primed to absorb that protein and accept that protein and help rebuild your muscles. It works very nicely if you get some kind of a branched chain amino acid supplement. That's a great thing to do immediately post-workout. Some people will report that they'll have less soreness if they have their branched chain amino acids right after working out. You can have a protein shake. And if you're not dairy intolerant, whey works great because whey is very absorbable and has immune globulins. If you don't want to do dairy protein, you can get vegetarian protein, and you can get some non-vegetarian proteins. You can get protein powders that are made from beef, believe it or not, and you get protein powders that are made from egg. And you can have those within half an hour of your workout. Or you can just eat chicken or bacon or a burger if you can get that in within a half hour of your workout and you absorb that well, that's another way you can do it. You can just eat some protein. And you can eat vegetarian protein. It's just hard to get concentrated vegetarian protein at the level that you might need after a workout. But by all means, you know, do a mixture of quinoa and beans or, you know, nuts and seeds right after your workout. And, you know, just taking care that you're getting the level of protein and amino acids that you need for your post-workout. But most people don't work out that hard. So the condom meat thing kind of works. But be aware, if what you're doing is you're eating a lot of starchy food, I'm not as concerned about the amount of protein you're eating if you're eating a lot of vegetables, if you're eating a lot of produce and you're having whatever level of protein works for you, then that's fine. But what I'm really interested in is why, you know, public health, that announcement was aimed at eating less meat and not aimed at eating less starch. I'm here to tell you, public service, it's a good idea to eat less starch and sugar, all right? Yeah. Think of your starch and sugar. Think of your pasta. Think of your rice. Think of your bread. Think of those as condiments that you want to have maybe 3 to 5 bites of them at a meal. And you can have unlimited nard and starchy vegetables, unless you're doing keto carnivore. And really, you can have as much protein as satisfies you, and just pay attention to what that means. There's only, I don't know about you, but there's only so much chicken breast I can eat. If I'm having fish, I have a shutoff switch. I just, you know, after a while, I can't eat anymore. Vegetables too. I mean, if you're having a huge salad, after a while, you know, and one of the things that happens to us, if we have pasta night, and by pasta night, Ron and I don't pile the pasta on. We don't have huge bowls of pasta.
No.
And you usually make more pasta than I can eat, and I don't finish it, and we get rid of it. So you just have to make me less pasta. And I really am happy with a handful of pasta. I'd much rather have lots more vegetables and have the protein, but because I don't need the carbs in that form. We find that if we eat a lot of the pasta, then we're not as hungry for the salad. Now, mind you, the pasta that we eat has fiber in it. So you have pasta with rice bran in it, and I usually have einkorn pasta, which has high in fiber. So there's only so much fiber. Fiber fills you up, and the more fiber you eat, the less you're going to want to eat. So eating stuff with a lot of fiber in it works. It's going to be very helpful for you. It's going to make you more regular. So that's something to focus on. If you're in terms of starchy foods, that's the thing that you should be eating as a condiment. I don't call it conda starch. I don't know, conda starch, conda sugar. But have, you know, if you want to have bread, have a little piece of bread. Or if it's sliced, have one slice of bread and have that with your big portions of non-starchy vegetables. And, you know, your satisfying portion of meat, of animal protein, if you're having animal protein. If you're not having animal protein, then your satisfying portion of beans, nuts, seeds, whatever that looks like. So, all right. So that was my rant. Okay.
It's a good rant.
I know.
So, a good rant.
So we have more highlights from the 2019 New Hampshire Association of Naturopathic Doctors Conference. So I'm going to highlight now what Dr. Wilson talked about. Dennis Wilson, MD. He has done a lot of research on Hashimoto's thyroiditis and hypothyroidism, and he's written books about it. And so we were very pleased to have him lecturing at our conference. And he even has a syndrome named after him. It's called Wilson syndrome. And Wilson syndrome is basically subclinical hypothyroidism. It's where you have symptoms of hypothyroidism that need to be treated, or that you have all the symptoms of hypothyroidism, but your numbers are normal. So, and he posits that you can have a normal TSH, that is your thyroid stimulating hormone, the hormone that comes from your pituitary gland that stimulates your thyroid to work, can be normal and you can still be hypothyroid. And one of the things that he finds is he really likes to increase people's metabolic rate. Before he treats people, his preference is to find out people's basal body temperature. And the basal body thermometer that he likes to use. So you can get an electronic basal body thermometer from any drugstore. He doesn't like people to use that. He likes to use a special mixed metal basal body thermometer. So that has different metals in it. I think it's mercury free, but it has metals in it. And he thinks that's more accurate than the electronic ones, which kind of makes sense. Yeah, because... with an electronic one has a sensor and it's going to approximate your body temperature. Whereas the metal is actually responding in real time on a scale based on what temperature it's reading. So you remember when you're a kid, you had either the alcohol, the ones with the red stuff inside it, or you actually had mercury thermometers,
right?
And so... those thermometers, if they have mercury inside of them, or either one, the mercury or the alcohol is responding to directly in real time. It's not an analog. It's warming those items up to a certain temperature, and it expands, at a certain rate, and your thermometer is calibrated based on the rate at which it expands. So it's you're getting a thermometer reading in real time, and that's why Dr. Wilson prefers that thermometer because it's not an analog; it's real. And you know when you go to Dr. LaGuardia's office, you get your blood pressure taken, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know that blood pressure is measured in milligrams of mercury. Did you know that?
No.
Okay, blood pressure is measured in milligrams of mercury.
Okay. And the reason, what does that mean?
So what it means is that mercury at certain pressures will take up a certain amount of space. And so at a certain pressure, mercury will rise to a certain number of millimeters. So if you look, next time you go to Dr. LaGuardia's, look on the wall when they take your blood pressure. I remember that from when I was a kid. There's an old-fashioned meter on the wall, and it's got a silver column in it, and that's mercury. So when you take your blood pressure, the cuff is attached to air, which is attached to, there's an air channel that blows into the tube that causes the mercury to rise. So again, that's not an analog blood pressure cuff. That's a blood pressure cuff that's measuring actual millimeters of mercury. When you have a blood pressure cuff that just has the dial on it and it's all air, that's called an analog. So you have a readout that's approximating what the mercury would look like when they take your blood pressure. And the neat thing to do would be to bring in an analog cuff and get your blood pressure taken both by the analog and the mercury cuff and compare. That'd be really interesting. All right. So you find out what your basal body temperature is, and if your basal body temperature is in the low 70s or below, then you have low basal body temperature. One of the things Dr. Wilson told us is that the average BMI, the body mass index in the U.S., and the body mass index is simply a function of weight and height, which doesn't give you the whole story about a person's body composition. It's because it's a function of just weight and height. And it's also not gender specific. But the average BMI in the U.S. is 30 now. And it used to be lower, but 30 is obese. So when he says average, I don't think he told us if that was mean, median, or mode.
Okay. So what was it before?
Not 30. I don't know exactly, but I mean, this is, and I'm not, I didn't write down when that started, like what year it became 30, but right now it's 30. That's what he said, the average BMI. So you know what the difference between mean, median, and mode average is?
You're going to tell me.
Yeah,
right now.
So the mean average is where you add up all the values and divide by the number of values. So if you have four numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, you add them all up and divide them by 4. Then you get the mean. All right, so that way you distribute the values among all the values. The median is you have a list of numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the median is the number in the middle of the list.
Okay.
So the median average of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is 3. Got that? Which
Got
is
it.
Not the same as adding them all together and dividing them by 5. But it might be the same. I don't know. I'm not sure. If you add up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and divide it by 5, are you going to get 3? I'm not sure.
I'm not doing that math right now.
I don't
now.
Think so. Mm, all right. No. And then the mode average is the value that occurs the most. And so the mode average can be if you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 5, even though 5 is not in the middle, 5 is the mode average. So... Okay, so you got that?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. So that's the mode. That's the difference between mean, median, and mode. And this big shout out to my friend Chris Green, who is going to be tutoring statistics. So this is a statistic thing. Anyway, so what I'm not sure of is this the median or the it's probably not the mode average, because that would mean that most people in the U.S. have a BMI of 30, and that's not true. But it could be the median, and it could be I'm guessing it's the median average, that it's the number that's right smack in the middle. That mean half the people in the U.S. have a BMI above 30, and half the people in the U.S. have a BMI that's below 30. But that's kind of disturbing if half the people in the U.S. have a BMI that's above 30, because that means that more than half the people in the U.S. are obese. When I used to start looking at these statistics, when I started studying them, it was probably 10, 15 years ago, we learned that 65 to 70% of people were overweight, which means they had a BMI of over 24.9, of 25 or above.
Okay.
So, and then 30% of those, I don't know if it's 30% of those or 30% of people in the U.S. were obese. And it could have been either one. That 30% of the people who have a high BMI were obese, or it could be 30% of all people in the U.S. is obese. This is suggesting half the people in the U.S. are obese, have a BMI of 30 or above.
That's pretty...
That's what he said. I'm not sure if every statistic says that at this time, but that's what Dr. Wilson said to us. That might be something you could check. What's the average BMI in the U.S.? Just ask, see if there's a search on that.
Let's ask.
All right. Meanwhile, he thinks that the metabolic rate and your body temperature are not only dependent on the TSH test. You can have normal TSH and still have low metabolism. So that's his whole thing, that people have low metabolism for lots of other reasons. And also something interesting that I didn't know about, that first of all, that there's I knew that T4 gets converted to T3. So in your body, active thyroid hormone is T4. That's thyroxine. Thyroxine has 4 iodine ions in it. And T3 has 3. Triiodothyronine has 3 iodines in it. All right. So T4 is not so active in your body. And your body most of the thyroid hormone in your body is T4. And this is one of those situations where nature put this together this way because you don't want to have the super active hormone always stimulating the receptors, because if you have T3 hyperstimulating your receptors, you become hyperthyroid. So most of your thyroid hormone is T4, and your body converts T4 to T3 as it needs to, which is a very smart system. Estrogen is similar in that most of the estrogen in your body is E3, which is estriol, and it's much weaker than E1 and E2. And you can convert E3 to E2, but at any one time, the estrogen in your body is going to be mostly E3, so that your estrogen receptors don't overstimulate, you don't get excessive growth, and you don't get cancer. You're less likely to get cancer. And so your body's very smart that way. Anyway, T4... So if you have too much T4 around, and also reverse T3 is T3 that has a structure that will bond to thyroid receptors, but it blocks them. It doesn't stimulate receptors; it blocks them. So it's one of the safeguards against overstimulation from thyroid hormone. But T4 and reverse T3. They increase the destruction of deiodinase. So there's this enzyme called deiodinase, and that's the enzyme that converts T4 to T3. So if you have too much T4 around, you can reduce your ability to convert that T4 to T3, which is interesting. So a lot of patients don't feel well on just T4. So that's why you can use whole thyroid. Also, I asked Dr. Wilson directly, you got diagnosed with Hashimoto's, and I said that, maybe it's not a good idea to give you whole thyroid. And that my concern was that if you give whole thyroid, which Dr. LaGuardia was willing to do, that it would give your antibodies something else to work on. Dr. Wilson didn't agree with that. He didn't think that whole thyroid aggravated Hashimoto's.
Really?
Yeah. So okay. That was good news. That's actually good news.
It's good for me, right?
Yes, it's good for you, in which case we can consider switching you to natural thyroid. If you're feeling fine on your thyroid hormone, you don't have to do that. But if you get to a point where you feel like you have to keep going up in your dose, we should probably switch you to natural thyroid hormone. And the reason to do that is because when you take whole thyroid, there's T3 in it. You don't have to worry about conversion as much, and you'll feel better on it. If you feel fine, taking your plain T4 right now, you may have enough active deiodinase and you're fine.
Okay.
Right. But that was an interesting thing to find out, that if you just get given T4, and that's often what happens. If you're hypothyroid and you've been given only levothyroxine, which can have the brand name Synthroid or some other brand names, Levoxyl. These are the number of brands, Tyrosynth. These are all brands of T4. T4, also known as levothyroxine. If you're on just that and you don't feel well, it's a good idea to have a conversation with your nice, friendly naturopath or you know, talk to your doctor or talk to somebody, get some more information, because there's some tweaks that you can do. And so the other thing that Dr. Wilson said that was very interesting to me is that T3 production is mostly intracellular and blood tests can't measure it, which is interesting because there is a free T3 and a T3 total blood test that you can do, and it measures the amount of circulating T3 and T4, T3 free and whole and bound T3, or all of your T3 in your blood. But you can have normal levels of that and supposedly be low in T3 intracellularly. How interesting is that? So if you're hypothyroid and you're taking medicine and you don't feel well, again, you should talk to somebody who would give you some tweaks. Then the other thing that Dr. Wilson said is, even if you come in with Hashimoto's, I don't know if I'd be comfortable with this. Somebody comes in with Hashimoto's and they have a TPO of, like, their thyroid peroxidase is beyond the sensitivity of the test. Like, their antibodies are over 1,000. And their TSH, I mean, your TSH when we first measured was 14. It was shocking.
That's bad.
It was high. It was really high. You were, okay, like, really hypothyroid. I was
tired a lot.
Well, yeah, you're going to be tired. I wouldn't be comfortable with just warming you up and then waiting and warming you up and then giving you I would want to give you thyroid medicine right away, because I would know you would feel better right away. And you did feel better right away, didn't you?
I'm less tired.
Yeah.
Than I was. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Definitely not as sleepy. I'm not having the morning or afternoon crashes that I was having before.
Right.
So it's better. I mean, I still get tired. I mean, everybody gets tired, right?
Yeah. This is something we have to pay attention to, and I might have a chat with, if you're not perfect, we might have a chat with Dr. LaGuardia that I changed my mind, that I think it's okay to give you whole thyroid.
Okay. Well, that's up to you guys.
Yeah.
You guys can work that out.
Yeah.
That's fine.
But like I said, now if you come in and you have hypothyroid symptoms, and, you know, your numbers are good, one of the things that I would often do is just give people adrenal support, which is fine. But what Dr. Wilson says is get their body temperature up and do things to help them raise their body temperature. So how do you help? Right.
I'm always cold. What do you mean body temperature up?
Yeah. So there are ways you can get your body temperature up.
Okay.
There are certain herbs that you can take that can help. And this is something we may want to look at for you, you can take. There's an herb called Google. Yes, it is. It's called.
It was in
existence before the search engine.
Yeah.
But it's called.
Ooh, they should sue for the name.
but it's spelled differently.
Okay.
Google, the search engine, came from a Googleplex, which is an astronomical number. It's a humorous word for an astronomically large number. And I'm sure that Google took that name because that way you could find out a bazillion different kinds of information. And bazillion is another. They could have called themselves bazillion, but they chose Google. And I remember my mother teaching me about a Googleplex. And Googleplex is just an astronomically large number, like a bazillion. It's like an undefined astronomically large number. So that's why that's called Google. But Google the herb is... it's an Ayurvedic herb, and it's used in Ayurvedic medicine. And I knew about Google. Well, that's not true. My mother told me about Googleplex when I was a kid, but I knew about Google the herb before the search engine came out because we studied Google in school.
In Google. You said Google.
So Google is an herb that can increase your metabolism. It can make you warmer. It can also help to regulate your cholesterol production. So it has some nice effects that way. Mm-hmm. Ashwagandha. Ashwagandha supports thyroid function. It's one of my new favorite herbs. It's thought of as Indian ginseng. I'm not sure which is thought of as the Indian ginseng, the ashwagandha or the holy basil. Because ashwagandha, whereas ginseng, Korean ginseng, you know, ginseng, the ginseng sinensis, that ginseng, I think of that one, I think of, you know, Chinese ginseng and Korean ginseng. I think of that one as somewhat stimulating. And then Panax ginseng is the one that's Chinese or Korean. And I think of that as somewhat stimulating. Panax kinkfolius, which is American ginseng, I think of that as more moderating. And Panax kinkfolius is the one that I would give to people if I want to help them regulate their blood sugar. And then Eleutherococcus used to be called Siberian ginseng. That's a lovely herb. I think of that as more of a balancer as well. Ashwagandha is also an adrenal tonic, but I think of ashwagandha as something of a nervine. It's calming of the ginseng-like compounds. It's a calming. You can use ashwagandha to help people with anxiety, but it also helps to regulate the adrenals and the thyroid, and, you know, it can help you with your body temperature. But more specifically, kelp and blue flag also can help improve your body temperature. So kelp, presumably, part of it is because it has iodine, but it has other things in it too. It has phytonutrients in it that are going to help, to regulate. It's going to help with not just the thyroid, it's going to help with the hypothalamus too. Blue flag is another one. So blue flag is wild iris, also known as wild iris. Mm-hmm. And blue flag is interesting because wild iris likes to grow in bogs. Do you know that, Canyon Road, right?
Yeah.
Remember sometimes they make you stop on Canyon Road? There's a big meadow there.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Blue Flag Meadow.
Yeah.
And I sometimes stop there and I look
there's
to see
There's a sign that says that.
There's a sign that says that. And so it's not called that because somebody waved a blue flag. It's probably called that because somebody saw a bunch of iris growing there.
Okay.
Yeah, and I stop there to see if there's iris growing. And sometime we should stop and, like, actually get off our bikes and go look. Not now, because it won't be growing right now and it's too cold.
It is cold.
Yeah, it's cold. But those herbs are among the herbs that can improve your body temperature. And then Google ashwagandha, ginseng. So Google and ashwagandha, but we talked about those. And Panax ginseng is somewhat stimulating. Holy basil as well, tulsi. Lovely, lovely herb. You can get Tulsi tea at the health food store. And again, it's both calming and energizing. It's really good for you. And also rhodiola. And rhodiola is a lovely herb. Rhodiola, by the way, is something if you're going to go, big shout out to our friends who summited. I'm not sure what the name of the peak they summited was, but they summited at 17,800 feet. But
ouch.
Rhodiola would have been good for them because rhodiola mm-hmm. is an herb that can help with altitude sickness, help prevent altitude, prevent and treat altitude sickness. And so I guess they figured out in Siberia because rhodiola has largely been studied in Russia. Just happens. The only thing with rhodiola, and I love rhodiola. I like to take rhodiola myself. But rhodiola, if you take enough of it and you're prone to mania, it can enhance mania. So if you're bipolar, probably not. I wouldn't give you if you have any chance of having bipolar disorder, I would not give you rhodiola. But it is other than that, if you don't have any tendencies towards mania, it's a very nice herb, and it helps you with your adrenal function and help you to have energy, and it supports thyroid function. So you can use all of these herbs. He says use these herbs before you go and give thyroid medicine, especially if the person is euthyroid, meaning that their numbers are good, that he really believes in helping the person work on their body temperature. Some other ways to work on your body temperature would be some ways to warm you up or to eat warming herbs like ginger and cayenne, mm-hmm. hot peppers and stuff like that, and horseradish, other things you can do. So here's a tough one, but I'll say it. And I said this to my office manager, Amy, and it made her shiver just to listen to it. But when you're taking a shower, take your shower, clean yourself off. You're taking your nice warm shower, yum, yum, yum. Mm. And then when you're just about done with your shower,
mm-hmm.
you turn on the cold.
Ick.
Yeah. And you point it first at your thyroid gland, which is the front part of the middle of your neck.
Okay.
And then your adrenals. And your adrenals are mid-back. So you point it at your mid-back. And you do it for as long as you can stand it. And if that means you can only stand it for 5 seconds, do it for 5 seconds. So one of the rules of hydrotherapy with cold is you do it for as long as you can handle it. And then you work up to 30 seconds. More than 30 seconds is too much. And then you get into the body's trying to work too hard on the cold. You want to shock your body a little bit with cold because it's going to draw circulation to the area. If you do a long cold, it'll ultimately drive circulation out of the area because things start to coagulate and slow down. But a short cold will draw, and think of what happens when you go out in the cold. What's the first thing that happens? Your nose turns red, your cheeks turn red, right?
Mm-hmm.
So being out in the cold air, you're getting circulation to the area. Well, if you put cold water on a part, you're going to get circulation to that area, and that's a good thing. So you do a short cold and go start with as long as you can stand it, up to 30 seconds, and that's it. If you can stand 30 seconds, yay. If you can't, then if you feel like it's too long, and you just work up to it. But you spray that cold, you do a cold spray on first your thyroid and then your adrenals, that is your mid-back, and it will draw circulation to those areas and help them function a little bit better. And that's something else that can increase your body temperature, just the hydrotherapy treatment. How cool is that?
That's cool.
Getting regular exercise will also raise your body temperature to a point. Unless you're stressed out, and if you are over exercising and you're stressing your body with the over exercise, then your body temperature is probably going to go down. But in general, getting exercise, I know for me that when I go to the pool, doesn't matter what time of year it is, if I get up and I'm sluggish and I'm cold and I go for a swim, if I go, you know, up to the community center and I get in a good swim, I come out and I'm so much warmer. I just feel so much better. Mm. And exercise in general, I think, you know, it just improves your circulation. And if you improve your circulation, you're going to be warmer. So that's another way. Now, the problem is that some people who, if they really feel like they're hypothyroid, it's very hard for them to exercise because they don't feel well. So if you're in that situation, then the thing to do is to just do what you can do, obviously. So if that means a 5-minute walk, walk for 5 minutes. If that means a 10-minute walk, walk for 10 minutes. If that means, you know, doing an exercise video but only doing the first 10 minutes of it, then do that. What you should do is what you could do. That's good advice, isn't it? You should do what you could do.
That is good advice.
And don't do what you can't do. Doctor, when I do this, it hurts. So don't do that. You know, so in summary, if you have normal thyroid values, whether you're taking medicine or not, and you feel like you're hypothyroid, talk to someone who could help you with this stuff. And, you know, your friendly local naturopath will probably be able to help you with this stuff. And understand that too much T4 can suppress your T3 function. And there's things we can do about that. The other thing is that we want to look at, we want to know about your selenium status. Are you consuming enough selenium? And
where would
you
get that?
Brazil nuts, for example. Brazil nuts are pretty high.
Oh, you know,
I stopped
doing that. I should start eating.
Yeah, you should do that.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
By the way,
you shouldn't have more than 200 micrograms of selenium a day is actually toxic.
So how many micrograms are in a Brazil nut?
One Brazil nut, I think it's 50. There's 50 micrograms in a Brazil nut. I'm pretty sure that's right. You can check on that, but I think it's 50. And that's why we tell people just have 2 Brazil nuts a day, because that'll put you at 100, and then all your other sources, you'll get your other 100. And, you know, that Brazil nuts are not something you should, like, snack on. If you have a Brazil nut, no more than 2, because you're going to get selenium from other sources in your food. And you can look up.
Such as?
So it's sources of selenium. I off the top of my head, what's selenium? I think selenium's in seafood. Selenium, yeah. Now, what are the selenium sources?
Okay, a single Brazil nut contains 68 to 91 micrograms of selenium, meaning that just one nut per day can provide the daily requirement of adult tolerance of 55 micrograms. And
So, it was selenium is in, it's mostly in animal protein, but it's also in Brazil nuts. There's something special about Brazil nuts.
Yeah, they're good for your thyroid.
Well, right, because selenium is one of the cofactors to convert, it's a cofactor for deiodinase to convert your T4 to T3. That's why it's good. So 1 ounce or 6 to 8 nuts has 544 micrograms. So 544 divided by 6 is going to be 90 odd, and 544 divided by 8 is going to be like 70-ish. All right, so there's like 50 to 90 micrograms in a Brazil nut. So that's why they tell you to only do 2 a day, because if there's 90...
Yeah, because 6 to 8 nuts is 544 micrograms.
Right, and you shouldn't have that many. So you
that's
should not... No, and you shouldn't be eating that. You should not eat that many Brazil nuts in a day. That's why you should limit it to 2, because a Brazil nut can have as much as 90 micrograms in one nut.
So 3 ounces of yellowfin tuna...
Yes.
92 micrograms.
Right.
Halibut cooked dry heat, 3 ounces, 47.
Yeah.
Sardines, canned in oil, drained solids with bone, 3 ounces, 45.
It's all like animal protein.
Yeah, ham, shrimp.
Chicken, cottage cheese,
macaroni
eggs.
Enriched, 1 cup.
Well, if it's been enriched with selenium,
Right. Beef steak, turkey,
when
beef
you start
liver,
getting
chicken.
Into...
Yeah, you're right. It's a lot of meat. A lot of it. There's a little bit in cottage cheese, rice, brown rice, hard-boiled eggs.
That's the other reason why they have you only eat 2, because there's a little bit in a lot of other foods. There's a bit in enriched foods.
So you're going to pick it up in other places, too.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yes,
we're going to stop by the co-op today and get some more.
Okay.
Brazil nuts. Because I was eating them fairly regularly there for a while.
And that's a good idea. If you look at your vegetable sources of selenium, they're not super high. So a whole cup of cooked brown rice only has 19 micrograms. And, you know, I don't need a whole cup at a sitting. And that's brown rice. And so it's not going to be in the white rice. Sunflower seeds and a quarter cup, which, you know, if you're having, you're snacking on sunflower seeds. So when you're getting into your plant proteins or your plant sources of selenium, you have to eat a lot of them to get a decent amount of selenium, which is why we recommend doing the Brazil. Brazil nuts are special because they are, because they're unusually high in selenium. It's just that species concentrates selenium. And selenium is important because it will help you convert your T4 to T3. Okay, so there you go. So let's wrap up a little bit. And I'm going to go through the stuff that Mary Bo told us, because she just gave us a few nice ideas of a few herbs that can be handy for you. So Mary Bo told us about rosemary and ginkgo. So I didn't think about rosemary this way, but rosemary can increase cerebrovascular flow. So if you are having cognitive issues, rosemary. So you know how you're getting that nice rosemary powder?
Mm-hmm.
We should use that in our food more.
Yeah, I like that.
Yes, and ginkgo as well. But rosemary, using rosemary in your food is a great thing. And lemon balm and spearmint are high in rosmarinic acid. So if you want to have a nice herbal tea, you can do lemon balm and or spearmint, and that could give you a cognitive boost.
Okay.
Also, bacopa. Bacopa is a really nice herb, and bacopa is an anti-anxiety. It can increase your serum calcium, but it can cause bowel irritability, and it is really good for intellect, memory, and forgetfulness. So bacopa is something I will give people sometimes for cognitive issues. And gotocola is a great herb for brain function. Gotocola is also something I think of for strengthening blood vessels. And then lion's mane's fruiting bodies. So lion's mane is this really interesting mushroom. So
okay.
If you see a picture of lion's mane, guess what it looks like?
It looks like a lion's mane,
probably. Yes, and it grows on trees. Does lion's mane grow on trees? Well, actually it does. And it's very pretty. It's kind of whitish or off-whitish, and it looks hairy, like a lion's mane. So you have to use the fruiting bodies, and apparently lion's mane has a little bit of a fishy taste. So if you like the fishy taste, no problem. But if you're not crazy about it, but you'd still like to use it, if you want to eat actual lion's mane mushrooms, then you should put them on your fish. You know? So you do you do some lion's mane herb. I would, and mushrooms in general should be cooked when you eat them because they have toxins in them that are inactivated when you cook them. So so if you can get lion's mane mushrooms, you know, put them on your fish, and then you get fish oil you get from the fish, and then you get lion's mane, and then you got a nice cocktail to help your cognition. All right. So I've still got more to get through. It's pretty incredible, and I'll have to decide if next week I want to talk about, because next week is the, I was going to say next week is the last Wednesday before Thanksgiving, but it's not. All right, so we'll get to more next week. So we're going to go now. So I hope you stay warm and do have your hot drinks and consider doing your hydrotherapy at the end of your shower, doing your final splash with cold, first to your throat and then to your adrenals, which is your mid back, and only as long as you can stand it. All right. So you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the call and talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions and comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores.